Our next case is David Henry Wood versus the People, case number 09, SC 990. Argument set for a half hour. Are both parties ready? Please keep track of your time and please state your name when you begin your argument. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Ingrid DeFranco. I'm here on behalf of petitioner David Wood. The court is considering whether or not the trial court's determination of the immunity provision is reviewable on appeal. If immunity goes to the court's subject matter jurisdiction, it is necessarily reviewable on appeal. A Colorado district court, despite having general jurisdiction and despite our presumption of jurisdiction, has no jurisdiction to consider conduct which does not create a criminal offense. Under the immunity provision, as this court found in McNeese, conduct which would otherwise constitute a criminal offense that is immunized by the statute is not criminal. Therefore, if immunity applies, there is no criminal conduct and a district court is not properly vested with jurisdiction to hear the case. Here, we had a fairly difficult determination about the trial court made very few findings, so we don't know precisely why he found that immunity didn't apply. He simply said it's not a closed case. The most likely reason for his determination is that the entry was invited. If, however, the decedent, who was the entrant, was present in the house under false pretenses because he was there to commit a crime, then the trial court could have considered whether consent was vitiated. And had the trial court found that there was no vitiation of consent, properly found that immunity didn't apply. The state argues that what we're asking a reviewing court to do is to sit effectively as a 13th juror and to reweigh the evidence that the jury considered when they convicted. That's not the case.
Before we get there, don't we have to decide whether or not this was an invited or uninvited entry?
I don't believe so, Justice Hobbs, because the court here isn't considering whether or not the trial court made an error. The court here is considering whether or not this determination is reviewable.
But the trial court was just deciding whether this statute applies to this case. That's the basis of the immunity claim. Is subsection 3 of this 18.1704.5.
That's correct.
And the immunity section clearly follows a provision that talks about an uninvited presence in the dwelling. And when the trial court says it isn't even close, how could under these facts, how could this possibly have been an uninvited entry?
Justice Hobbs, if the entrant had secured an invitation under the pretense that he was there to, as there was some evidence.
Well, this was a drug deal, right? An alleged drug deal.
The person that committed
the murder is actually the owner of the house, right?
Residents
invited this person in for the purposes, allegedly, of doing this drug deal.
Right, or of sharing drugs.
Right.
There's some conflicting evidence on that.
Okay.
If the entrance reason for going into the house had been to rob Mr. Wood, which it's Mr. Wood's testimony that that was his reason for going in, then the consent for him to be in the home would have been under false pretenses, and that consent could well have been vitiated by his intention to commit a crime in the dwelling, and the at least according to Mr. Wood, did begin to commit an assault.
It's a pretty brave enlargement of the intent of this self-defense provision, isn't it? This uninvited entry and the ability to use deadly force. I mean, aren't you asking us, in effect, to take the statute much beyond what the cases have held it does?
I don't think the courts have considered a case similar to this before, where the entry was under false pretenses. But if I were to secure an invitation into your home because you believed I was there to do one thing, and what I was in fact there to do was something violent to you, your consent to my being there would be vitiated by my intention to commit a crime against you. And at that point, if I were there to kill your child, and you didn't know that when you invited me into the house, the immunity provisions of the Homeowner Act would then come into play, because you are entitled to be secure in your own home against those who would come in either through a violent, forcible entry or through trickery to do harm to you in your own home.
I take you back to the review question. You started off by saying this is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, pretty obviously, I guess you wouldn't argue that, would you, that an affirmative defense, if an affirmative defense is proven, that would deprive the court of subject matter jurisdiction. So I presume you mean only because this is to be decided by a judge before trial, that makes it a matter of subject matter jurisdiction?
That's correct.
Wasn't the rationale of Gunther deciding that the statute really created two things, an affirmative defense and an immunity to be ruled on by the court, based on the language of the statute that actually said if these elements were present, if they were proved, that the defendant would be immune from criminal prosecution, not that he would be innocent or not guilty of the crime?
If you recall, the original statute before the compromise bill came out, what the legislature said there was that conduct constituting a homicide under these circumstances would be presumptively reasonable conduct. And that's indicative of the General Assembly's intention to say this is not criminal.
That language in the statute?
The presumptively reasonable conduct? No, because it was replaced then by the immunity from prosecution.
And do I understand it right that the thrust of Gunther was, in saying that the judge would rule on this, was the fact that they chose to phrase it that way, that he would be immune from prosecution, and therefore the point of having this kind of an immunity, of having this kind of a provision for the benefit of the defendant, would be to keep him from having to go through a trial?
Correct.
Okay.
And this court in Meese, looking at that language and concerned with weighing, on the one hand, the right to be safe in your own home, and on the other hand, circumstances under which wanton homicide could occur, said that this conduct would constitute a criminal offense but for the statute. And that says it therefore does not constitute a criminal offense. Or I think it can most reasonably be read to say that.
No, please.
I'm wanting to understand, why isn't Rule 21 the appropriate avenue for relief for this?
It's certainly an avenue. Rule 21 is proper whenever a court is acting without jurisdiction or exceeds its jurisdiction, but it's not the only one. Because if the court doesn't grant the Rule 21 for whatever reason, and the trial court has erred in finding that the defendant is not immune from prosecution, then there must be some further avenue of relief. Because if, in fact, he did not commit an offense, then the trial court can't hold him to account for those charges and can't properly try him for that, regardless of what the jury finds.
I guess I'm sort of coupling my question with what Justice Coates just asked, which is the point of this seems to be to allow the defendant to avoid prosecution altogether.
Correct.
So it would seem that the proper juncture at which to appeal that ruling would be at the Rule 21 stage, not post-trial, at which point he's already faced trial.
I agree, but we can't. He has no mechanism by which to compel this court to accept an original action.
But isn't the point, and I think People versus Paul pointed this out, that it's the opportunity to be able to petition for that immediate review, which is a realistic opportunity in this context. Isn't that sufficient and adequate for reviewing this type of claim?
No. Because if through some set of circumstances the court doesn't accept review, defense counsel doesn't elect to take a Rule 21, the court still proceeds without jurisdiction because there is no criminal offense. That is properly reviewable on appeal.
Excuse me. I just wanted to follow up on that. I had a question kind of along those same lines. If I understand your position, you're saying this should be somewhat analogous to the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act's provision where there's a direct appeal from the denial of immunity. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding?
I think that the closest cognate would be sovereign immunity. But sovereign immunity is more difficult because this statute is in derogation of the common law, at least somewhat. Sovereign immunity is the common law since the 1600s, at least in the Colorado legislature, has said that British common law will obtain in Colorado except where it's changed by the legislature. So I think it's difficult.
I think they both are in derogation of the common law to a certain degree. So I think the analogy, at least in my mind, might be somewhat helpful, and I wanted to explore it because in the CGIA context, the legislature was very clear that there would be an immediate appeal, that the immunity was from suit.
That's correct.
But the absence of that kind of language in this particular provision, the Make My Day provision, would suggest that classic statutory interpretation, the legislature knew how to give an immediate appeal, knew how to make something immune from suit, but somehow chose not to. What's your opinion with respect to that?
We have to assume that the legislature also knew that a trial court proceeding in a matter in a criminal case where there was no criminal offense at issue was proceeding without its jurisdiction, and that appeal would also lie from that.
Is immunity from suit the same as a lack of general jurisdiction?
No.
The court still has jurisdiction, just the defendant is immune from going from suit. I think those concepts are somewhat different, aren't they?
The court certainly has jurisdiction to hear a first-degree murder case. What we believe immunity provides is that the court shall have no jurisdiction to hear a first-degree murder case when a defendant meets the criteria for statutory immunity, because when he meets those criteria, his conduct does not constitute an offense and does not vest the court with jurisdiction.
Yeah.
If I may retain my 2 minutes.
Sure.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people in this matter. This court needs to decide whether a ruling denying Make My Day immunity is reviewable on direct appeal because there's a split of the court in the Court of Appeals on this issue. There are three published opinions from the 1990s reviewing immunity rulings on direct appeal, and then the Court of Appeals decision in this case, which holds that these rulings are not reviewable. Before I get into my argument, though, briefly, I do want to respond to Justice Hobbs' question of the petitioner on the merits of this case, because I think if this court were to decide that the immunity ruling is reviewable, it would need to address the merits. And I believe that the trial court said that this was not a close call, because it was undisputed that the defendant invited the victim into his home. And when there's an invitation to enter into the home, there's no unlawful entry as a matter of law. I think the defendant's incorrect in trying to analogize the facts of this case to a burglary by arguing that there was an unlawful entry because the victim entered with the intent to commit theft or any crime. And I think that's really misunderstanding the case law, because the unlawful entry looks to whether the entry was unlawful, and it is completely irrelevant what the victim's purpose was after entering.
So what did the legislature mean when they used the word immune?
Immunity, my understanding of what immunity means based on the statute and legislative history is that immunity is an opportunity for a defendant to preempt the prosecution's case in a clear-cut case where he could show the elements of the statute. There is nothing in the statute or the legislative history that indicates that immunity is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And I think our case law is clear that in order to have subject matter jurisdiction, in a criminal case, that there is a crime committed in the state of Colorado. And here, the court had the power to hear this case because the defendant was charged with first-degree murder in Colorado.
So do you think the word immunity was just a bad choice of words?
I don't know that it was a bad choice of words. I don't think it's clear from the statute what immunity means, but I think when you look at the discussion of how the genesis of the statute, when you look at the legislative history, that the immunity provision was added to spare the defendant the burden and expense of trial in situations where he could show the elements of the statute.
So this is something a little bit more than a defense.
But it's
not an absolute bar, because if there were an absolute bar, then there would be a direct appeal, wouldn't there?
Yeah, the statute certainly doesn't say it's an absolute bar, and I think that immunity and affirmative defense are two different things, and they each come into play at different stages of the trial. At the pretrial stage, the defendant has the burden of showing by a preponderance of the evidence the conditions of the statute, and if he shows them, then that's the end. But if the defendant fails to show those elements, then we go to trial. And at that point, the affirmative defense comes into play. And the entire purpose of the immunity hearing pre-trial is moot, because the defendant does have to go to trial and, you know, try to convince a jury that he was justified, you know, using the Make My Day affirmative defense. And I think that's precisely why Rule 21 relief is the only avenue for a defendant, because Rule 21 is designed specifically, I think, for this type of situation where you have, if you think the trial court, you know, made the wrong call on the merits at the immunity hearing, and there's no adequate remedy on appeal, because once you go to trial and you have to make my day affirmative defense, the pretrial ruling is going to be moot. So I do think that this is...
You use an interesting term there, immunity hearing. So what is this, sort of a sui generis de novo kind of innovation in the criminal law for this circumstance, where there's some kind of an evidentiary hearing that the trial court conducts, and the defendant apparently has to ask for and bear the burden of proof on?
I think that's what was decided in the Gunther case, is okay. That's how this would play out. By immunity hearing, I'm referring to the pretrial hearing where the defendant is claiming immunity under the Make My Day statute. So I think that's the procedure that this court set forth in Gunther, is that there would be a pretrial hearing where the defendant would have the burden of proof by a preponderance, and then once we get to trial, the prosecution has the burden of disproving the Make My Day affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you.
Counsel,
go ahead.
I might follow up again on ask you essentially the flip side of the Rule 21 question. What if that is a proper avenue for relief, what would be the basis for that relief? Is it not in that context that the trial court was acting in excess of its jurisdiction? And if that's true, is it not then a jurisdictional question?
Well, I think when we say the trial court was acting in excess of its jurisdiction, it's really not the same thing as subject matter jurisdiction. I think in that situation, that understanding of jurisdiction is that you might be saying that the trial court is acting in excess of its statutory authority. I think the other sort of way to get Rule 21 relief is that you say the trial court has abused its discretion and an appellate remedy is not available.
So akin to some of the comments in McMurtry, sort of distinguishing between subject matter jurisdiction and general power of the court.
McMurtry, it disavowed the suggestion in, I think the case was called Hampton from 1980, that was talking about why speedy trial is not jurisdictional. And they said that, you know, we were in Hampton and speaking about it being jurisdictional, we were really referring to a trial court acting in excess of its statutory authority, which is a different thing from subject matter jurisdiction.
So the Court of Appeals, go ahead.
I'd actually like to talk to you about the part of your argument that the decision after the jury verdict is moot. That is, what you're suggesting is the jury's decision has really encompassed all the immunity considerations by virtue of its determination on the affirmative defense. Is that right?
Yes.
And so, as an aside, I guess I would first ask, in this particular case, I just want to make sure I understand, were we to choose to review this, if we decided it is reviewable, in your view, it's a very simple review because there's no legal error that the judge made. It's just a question of weighing facts, and there's plenty of facts to support the judge's preponderance determination, right?
That is true, although in this case, the trial court didn't make specific findings of fact as to each of the three elements. The court said it's not in my judgment, I think was the ruling.
All right, so the conceivable question would be whether that fails to imply some credibility decision as to the disputed facts.
No, I would agree that that's probably...
So it's a pretty simple review.
It is a simple review in this case.
In this case.
You can say also that there was no unlawful entry as a matter of law.
Okay.
I think the case lawfully supports.
But where I wanted to go with you is on the moot issue, is the trial judge's decision ever reviewable if it isn't reviewable on direct appeal? And you're basically saying it's moot. And so I guess my question is the determination at the end of the trial, in your view, is entirely synonymous with, entirely identical to the judge's immunity determination?
Well, it's the same three elements of Make My Day that the jury has said that the prosecution has disproven beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a higher standard than the inquiry at the pretrial stage. And I think that's why the Court of Appeals in this case was analogizing findings of probable cause at a preliminary hearing and denials of summary judgment, because both of those proceedings involve where this court has said that those proceedings are moot once the case goes to trial, because once the jury finds liability at a higher burden of proof, they necessarily affirm the pretrial ruling.
Now, so is that decision of the jury reviewable?
I think the decision of the jury would be reviewable if the defendant wanted to claim that there was insufficient evidence.
Is the review of insufficient evidence, is that review identical to the review of the court's immunity decision, or greater than?
It's not going to be necessarily the same, because when we're reviewing a jury verdict, we're looking at the record as a whole. And so when you're looking at an immunity ruling, you're only looking at the facts presumably presented at the immunity hearing. But juries don't make findings of fact. And they don't make, statements on issues of law. They say, guilty or not guilty. Whereas in this case, you could have a trial court ruling that makes specific findings of facts or states specific things as far as how the statute is interpreted. So you could have a situation.
So where this is going is, would it not be possible for a judge to erroneously decide that the preponderance question on the immunity issue, for the case to go to the jury, the jury convicts, the court's review of that, whether by the trial court or subsequently, is whether the evidence is sufficient. So could we not have an inconsistency? That is, could the evidence be sufficient to sustain a jury verdict of beyond a reasonable doubt, but nonetheless at the immunity hearing, it was not presented or convincing by a preponderance of the evidence? Is that a possibility?
I mean, I think it is a possibility. And I think 2 points on that. One, I think this court has already said in the context of preliminary hearings and summary judgment motions, both of which I think could lend itself to your hypothetical, that the later ruling under the higher burden of proof moots the earlier ruling. And then I think...
Oh, and what I'm really getting at here is, does it in this case as well? Because I have some question about whether it does, since we would only subsequently look at sufficiency.
I'm not sure.
But what I'm trying to get at is it possible that someone who is immune after the immunity hearing, but the judge makes the wrong ruling, could eventually be convicted and the conviction could be sustained because the review is on sufficiency rather than on preponderance at the immunity hearing?
Right. Okay, I'm sorry. And I do think that's possible, and I think this court has stated in analogous context that that's the absurdity of the rule, the review of the earlier ruling. Because it is possible that you could have, you know, the prosecution could just sit back and do nothing at the immunity hearing and, you know, and then present a much better case at trial. But I think we say, you know, it would be absurd to require the prosecution to prove its case entirely at the immunity hearing. And I think, you know, a consequence of saying that the immunity ruling is reviewable is that you're essentially going to have two full-blown trials because the prosecution is going to need to bring out its best proof at the immunity hearing.
So, in your view, it's satisfactory that the immunity determination could be wrong, and if reviewed, could be reversed. But nonetheless, because you have a conviction based on sufficient evidence, that that's satisfactory. And I guess that takes it back to your earlier argument, because this isn't true immunity. This is just an initial limit.
Right. And I suppose, you know, I think you're forgetting the possibility of Rule 21 relief, because I think if a defendant truly believes that the trial court got it wrong at the immunity hearing, he or she needs to seek Rule 21 relief before you go to trial. Because once you go to trial, the purpose of that immunity ruling is to see whether the case should go to trial. So at the moment it goes to trial, that proceeding is, it's over. And then, you know, I think you are left with the remedy of appealing the sufficiency of the evidence at that point.
And Nate, just one other question, and that is, assuming just arguendo for a moment, that the immunity decision should be reviewed together with the sufficiency of evidence question, if raised, on appeal, would that present some difficulties? In other words, could you have scenarios where the evidence is sufficient, the immunity decision, either because the basis of it isn't known, or there was a legal error there which wasn't repeated in the instructions, or for some other reason, you could have a defective immunity ruling with nonetheless evidence sufficient to establish a case beyond a reasonable doubt?
I mean, I think if you have sufficient evidence to support the jury's rejection of the Make My Day affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt, then I am not concerned with a defective immunity ruling if a defendant has...
It's your procedural concern. I mean, if we went that way, we could have that verdict, but we have, however, an immunity ruling that's not sufficient. What do we do with it?
I'm sorry, if you have...
If we said immunity was reviewable, and therefore, you know, it needs to be... And the review finds that the ruling was made in, you know, insufficient basis or erroneously in some way, how would you fix or correct that, even though at this point in time you have a sustainable jury verdict of guilty?
And I think the purposes of, when you look back to the purposes of Make My Day immunity, I think it would be incorrect for you to be reviewing the immunity proceeding on direct appeal. I think when you look at the purposes of Make My Day and...
What you're saying is, because it could result in overturning a conviction for an immunity determination, notwithstanding the fact that the evidence is sufficient for beyond a reasonable doubt and has been found that way.
Well, I mean, I do think it's mooted by the jury's verdict, as a matter of fact, and I think it's also, you know, this court has stated in analogous context that would be absurd to overturn an immunity ruling when you have a jury verdict supported by sufficient evidence.
So, Dal, I think your
time's
up.
I apologize.
Thank you.
I'd ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
Is there a rebuttal, Mr. Franco?
There was a case in which the trial judge said to the prosecution, "I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that immunity doesn't apply. You have to convince me beyond a reasonable doubt that immunity doesn't apply." And he dismissed. That was subsequently appealed, and of course, it was reversed. So we could very easily, Justice Martinez, have a situation in which the trial judge said, I think you have to prove to me beyond a reasonable doubt that you meet the statutory conditions for immunity. You haven't done that. We're going to trial. We go to trial. There's a jury verdict finding you guilty of either first-degree murder or, as is typically the case in these cases, some lesser offense. It's generally when this affirmative defense is presented at trial, the jury brings in a verdict on a much lesser count. So then we have a jury verdict that is certainly reviewable, but what we had in the initial determination was an error of law requiring this defendant to stand trial where he was immune.
Why isn't that error, in the face of a jury verdict, sustainable by evidence sufficient to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? Why isn't that error at best really of a procedural nature? Either the prosecution didn't present enough evidence at the time, or in your example, the judge misunderstood the test. However, had he understood the test, presumably would have arrived at the result that there's no immunity. So why isn't that decision by the trial judge ultimately made, if not assumed or mooted, it becomes merely a procedural error in the face of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, does it not?
No, because then you cannot give effect to the legislature's intent that this conduct not constitute an offense for which a defendant could be prosecuted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both attorneys for your argument. Case submitted on the briefs and the court.